Rep 242?
244. We're using this one again.
Hope you guys enjoyed. It was brought to you by our good friends at Unchained Capital right down the hall. Hear from me in the Bitcoin comments. They've got this new inheritance protocol. Yesterday on TFTC, I called it a retirement protocol, but it's not right. It's inheritance. Retirement to the afterlife protocol, as we're running with right now. If you're a Bitcoiner out there, you've got Bitcoin, you've got it in self-custody, but you're the Uncle Jim of your family. Your wife doesn't know what to do. Your husband doesn't know what to do. Your parents don't know what to do. Your kids don't know what to do. You're holding the keys by yourself, holding that burden. You tell your wife, hey, if anything happens to me, go call Matt. He'll know what to do. How confident can you be that Matt will know what to do? Probably going to want something more ironclad than that. And that's what our friends at Unchained Capital have developed with their inheritance protocol. So if you are a Bitcoin holder who would like to pass down your sats to your family members, and are looking for the product to do that, Unchained has built it for you. They've also built their Vault product, or 203 Multisig, their IRA product, an IRA that allows you to hold your own keys, a trading desk, lending desk. Everybody's pretty hot down there too. I don't know if you've noticed that, Logan. Have you ever peeped down the hall?
On occasion.
Pretty hot company they got there at Unchained Capital.
Sure.
A lot of... Okay, there we go. Go to unchained.com. Last consultation. Use the code RHR or TFTC. Set up a consultation for the Vault Inheritance Protocol. Learn about their trading desk, their IRA. Do it all. Hit them up. Hit the hot people up. This was also brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. CoinKite is here to build the best hardware in the space. We've got the beautiful block clock right next to me. Currently reading $23,428. It's the Bitcoin price, according to the block clock right now. We've got their MK4 wallet out there. We talked about the big update of the MK4 this week. Matt was all hot and bothered by the new feature that makes it so if you actually want to access your wallet, you have to have the micro SD chip in there. And if it's not in there and somebody tries to put their pin in, poof, wipes it. It's just like one of many cool features that the team at CoinKite is building into their cold card wallets. MK4 is top of the line. It's got two secure elements. You create private public key pairs offline in an air gap fashion. You can add entropy to those private keys by rolling dice. It's NFC enabled. You also have NFC enabled card form factors in the tap signer, and the Sats card tap signer is a key, NFC enabled key on this credit card form factor. You use it with compatible apps like Nunchuck. Tap it on the back of your phone. You assign the key so you can separate your mobile device with a wallet. You can receive Bitcoin there. Then if you want to send Bitcoin, you need the mobile wallet and your tap sign, your tap broadcast. Sats card similar, NFC enabled card form factor, but it's more similar. It's more akin to the Open Dime, which allows you to load it up with Bitcoin. You tap it on the back of your phone. You click the link to the browser. Boom, address associated with that Sats card pops up. You load it up. You go to a wedding, you go to your bookie, go to coinkite.com, use the code RHR. Still don't know if we have a code. Enjoy this, Rip Freaks. It's a long one, but a very good one. Dickie.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Too late. He launched it. Logan just, woo! We're here, freaks. What a week.
We're good. What I was going to say was, let me just double check Restream to make sure we're good. Oh. But we are.
YOLO. Send. We're live. What a week. I'm exhausted. We've had a lot of travel.
We've got.
Dude, my brain isn't working.
Mine's definitely not working at full capacity. Had a beefsteak here in Austin last night. Went late. Ribeye didn't come out till midnight. And as you know, with the beefsteaks, you have to stay for the ribeye. So I got a little bit of sleep.
Ribeye's always last. Best for last.
Great vibes.
We had at Bitcoin Park in Nashville, we had a banger meetup yesterday. We had like 150 people in town. And of course, we were talking about the bank crisis and how Bitcoin fixes this. Topic of the week.
Yes, you guys have Preston, Pish, and Jesse Myers on stage talking about this. Any insight?
And we had Trey Sellers from Unchained.
Oh, shout out to Trey as well.
We had Josh Hendrickson. It was Preston, Josh, and Rod, my co-founder of Bitcoin Park, BitKite, for the first panel. And then it was me, Jesse, and Trey for the second panel. And then before that, I ripped a dispatch with Jesse. I got back from art, and like me and you were on a work trip, and I got back and I just immediately recorded a pod with Jesse, and then immediately went to meet up right afterwards. And I got like, and then I posted Lionel Shriver's Bitcoin address and got over a Bitcoin worth of donations. Then I got like 6 hours of sleep, and then I woke up and here we are. Well, there was a whole morning involved this morning, but
yeah. Yeah, we've got Bitcoin Takeover Week here in Austin, Texas. Had a great event with the Human Rights Foundation yesterday. I think they launched it today on Twitter, but they previewed their 9-minute video clip on the CFA and how the French are essentially colonizing parts of Africa with their,
it's so fucked up,
their CFA currency. Very great video. If it is live, go watch it. 9 minutes. Very impactful. Really highlights. Do you have one of those desks that, like, what'd you just do there?
Yeah, I just raised my desk.
Look at you. High tech in the new office.
No, I've had this desk already. It's been a minute. This desk was, I just usually mute it or do it before we're recording, but my mind's not working.
I didn't take you for a mechanical desk guy. I thought you'd have like a nice mahogany old school.
No, it's one of those adjustable standing desks because I like using it as a standing desk. It was a $200K by conference day purchase.
Standing desk.
I've had it for like 2 years now.
Espresso machines. Lots of champagne.
It really isn't. They're not that expensive now. It's like $600 bucks or something.
We've got more events. We got BitDevs tonight here in Austin. 10:31 we'll have our tribe event. You will be missed. And then tomorrow we'll have a full day of panel talks and discussions about Bitcoin at the official takeover event. It feels like a Tuesday, but we're here Thursday. Obviously it's Thursday because we're recording Rabbit Hole Recap. Last week we did a remote rip. I was in one place, not in Austin. You were in Nashville. And the world was melting. As we were speaking, banks were failing. Silicon Valley Bank went under right before we recorded last week. And I guess at the end of the episode, we're like, this is probably going to continue. And obviously, if you've been paying attention, a lot has continued. So we had the bank failures continue into the weekend, but there's a lot of nuanced discussion around them, which we're going to jump into, I think. Particularly around Signature. It was a bit odd what happened there. But before we do that, we didn't do it last week. Got to make sure we do it this week. We'll dive into Clark's dashboard, give you guys an update on the state of the Bitcoin network.
We didn't do Clark's dashboard last week?
No.
Wow. That was a fuck up. That's got to be the first week in a long, long time that we didn't.
Yeah. The price of Bitcoin right now is 24,746. 40 cuck bucks. One cuck buck is going to get you 4,044 sats. Currently sitting at a $477.3 billion market cap. We are block height 781,078. We are currently 1,130 blocks away from the next difficulty retarget, which is estimated to be 5.9% right now and will occur on March 21st, or is estimated to occur. I just said March 21st. March 24th. 2023, so that's in 8 days. I believe, did we? I think the difficulty adjustment happened right before last week, but since we didn't read the dashboard last week, the last adjustment that happened was a 1.2% upwards adjustment. So that means we're sitting at a difficulty all-time high of 43.6 trillion. Samurai unspent capacity, or before that, Clark's mempool has 24,796 transactions in it, and unspent capacity in Samurai Whirlpool is 6,715.15 Bitcoin, or 165.8 million cup bucks in unspent value. That is the state of the network. Bitcoin, I think we pull this in, I mean, the price of Bitcoin in the midst of all these bank failures and this contagion that has spread over to European markets and their banking sector has performed pretty well this week.
Marty, it was up 20% on Monday morning. Talk about a fucking understatement.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like initially last Friday, it dumped under 20, went to like low 19s. Then as the weekend progressed and markets opened on Monday, it seems like, who knows what happened? Did people see what happened to Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, see that they went under and they didn't have access to their deposits? And then they had this light bulb go off where, oh, there's a lot of counterparty risk here. Maybe I should hold some of my money in an asset that doesn't have that counterparty risk. Or was it a reaction to an increased likelihood that the Fed is going to reverse their interest rate policy and begin lowering rates? And
I think it was the price of money printer go burr. Yeah, I think it was existing Bitcoiners pricing in QE5 starting. Because I mean, I do think there's a very strong learning experience here for a lot of people on the beauty of Bitcoin being money without trust, that banks have inherent counterparty risk, that the whole system is essentially just one big Ponzi banking system, where if everyone tries to pull their money out at the same time, you're not going to be able to get your money. That is definitely, it definitely opened a lot of people's eyes this weekend, I think. Similar to 2008, how 2008 shaped me and you. I think 2023 will shape a lot of people going forward. But it's important to realize that, you know, if you're a company that had maybe, you know, a startup that had $10 million on SVB, and you got your money back because the U.S. government is backstopping everyone's deposits over there, and you want to put a portion of that into Bitcoin to make sure that you can always pay payroll in the future and that doesn't happen to you again, it's still going to take you like 8 days, 10 days to onboard with an exchange, get the transfer over, buy the Bitcoin. Like, we haven't seen that yet. And I expect that to be more of a long tail kind of trend that we see, that you can't just like get into Bitcoin right away. Most people can't.
Completely agree. And so leaning into this bailout, I mean, obviously that happened after we recorded last week. We ended that podcast with a bit of uncertainty as to what was going to happen. I think we all agreed it was likely that these banks were going to get bailed out, but it officially happened. And you mentioned QE5, and I recorded with Parker on Monday of this week. If you freaks haven't caught that episode, go check it. Extremely grounding first principles episode that really gets to the crux of the core of this problem, which isn't how these banks are managing their capital reserves and the debt instruments that they're using as liquidity tools to service withdrawals. It really comes back to Fed policy and the fact that there is a lot of debt and not enough dollars to service that debt. And as the Fed has raised interest rates and pulled dollars out of the system, it was inevitably going to break somewhere. It just so happened to be Silicon Valley Bank.
Me and Marty are obviously going to continue talking about it right now on Rabbit Hole Recap because it's an extremely important topic. But Marty and Parker went really far at length on the topic on TFTC. And me and Jesse Myers went really far on length on Sill Dispatch. So, I mean, I advise you freaks to go listen to both of those episodes after Rabbit Hole Recap if you haven't already listened to it, because they're both very in-depth, and our time here is short and we're covering a bunch of things. So,
yes, but the crux, going back to QE5, so Parker, and I haven't listened to the Jesse episode, so I don't know if he agrees, and stated this as well. Parker asserted that QE5's already started, so the bailout of Silicon Valley Bank, essentially the Fed and the FDIC and the Treasury came together and then made an announcement Sunday. Hey, we're going to make depositors whole. And for these banks with these debt instruments, we're going to create a facility where we will take the debt instruments you have at par value. Let's say they're trading at 85 cents on the dollar. We'll put them on our balance sheet and give you a dollar worth of cash in exchange. And then we'll hold that. And at some point in the future, we'll settle up. So that is essentially the mechanics of this bailout.
But I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, right? So the first part of the announcement that we're going to make depositors whole at SVB and Signature Bank while wiping out all shareholders and leadership, right? That is obviously, that's the U.S. government backstopping these deposits. They say, you know, quote unquote, that no taxpayer money is being used towards that. That's probably a bold-faced lie, but there is aspects of them selling assets to pay for a lot of that. And those banks were close to solvent, if not fully solvent already. They just got hit by this bank run and they had these duration issues with their bonds. But that second part where they're providing loans to bonds that are underwater, whether those are mortgage-backed securities or whether those are government bonds, treasury bonds, and they say it's going to be a loan for a year, but there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government policy. That part is a full-on bailout. QE5 has started, and that's a bailout for all other banks. Like not like if that existed before SVB got bank runned, SVB would still be alive. But they basically preemptively bailed out every single other bank in existence.
Yes, that is exactly what's happening right now. And there's no way that this is a one-year temporary policy. It's going to expand.
Exactly.
They need to print trillions and trillions of dollars to stem this crisis. They're probably not going to be hiking anymore. Because the more they hike, again, bonds have this inverse correlation. The price of the bonds has the inverse correlation with the interest rate. So if they hike more, the value of those bonds goes down. And this is essentially what happened last week. The banks were forced to sell these debt instruments to service withdrawals. And as they're selling, the price is going down even further. So it just creates this cascading doom loop that is only solvable by injecting more cash into the system. So moving forward, you can expect that the Fed and the government is going to like if you thought 2020 was insane, like moving forward, the amount of money they're going to have to print is going to be unfathomable. Potentially Weimar levels.
Yeah, Fed futures markets are already starting to price that in significantly. Bitcoin is starting to price that in significantly. It is the expectation. And it's important to realize that this is, you know, fractional reserve systems,
Matt,
require bailouts to function.
Yes.
Because they will just constantly blow up over and over again. And there's an important thing to keep in mind here. If you go to the Federal Reserve's press release site, the last press release they had was right before the last press release they had before announcing the SVB measures and the SVB bank failure and them taking Signature Bank out back and shooting it and zeroing out shareholder value and announcing their bailouts was them denying Custodia, which is Caitlin Long's full reserve bank, even more than full reserve. Caitlin Long's bank was supposed to be her plan by mandate. 108%. So if you put $100 in deposits, you would have $108 in the bank, and they would just make money from good old fashioned fees rather than rehypothecating funds and lending out customer funds. And the problem here is in a fractional reserve Ponzi banking system, you can't have a bank that is fully reserve because all the banks will be run and they'll go to the safe bank. In this exact situation, if Custodia existed, when people were rushing to withdraw, you know, maybe some go to Bitcoin, maybe some go other places, but a lot of funds would be going to the fully reserved bank. So you can't have a single fully reserved bank in this system without further compromising every other bank that exists.
Yeah, you'd have a run that's the reason why they're not letting Custodia through. Because if you have a fully reserved bank, everybody's going to run to it. Matt, you saw me putting my fingers up. We have a potential guest from the Commons. Would you be okay with Thomas Pakia joining us?
Of course.
And I think particularly to dive into the signature situation, because that's
a whole other... You're the shoe guy.
He's the shoe guy.
I always like having get. Oh, I said, yeah. You like shoeing people. I like always, whenever someone's at the park or at the Commons, I would love if we have a ride or die freak there, they should always come on the show. That's all awesome. Right.
Thomas is going to join us, freaks, and we're going to touch on signature. Logan, can we do some?
While Thomas is getting set up, just on this Custodia Bank line, right? So the reason Custodia Bank is getting denied is because to be a bank in the United States, you need the Federal Reserve's permission to join the Federal Reserve System. And they will never give permission to a bank like that because it will compromise all of their bullshit banks. So what is our option? Our option, the only other option we have is Bitcoin. The only other option we have is a money that does not require permission, that you're able to hold without trust in self-custody, that you're able to easily verify with your own node. This is why Bitcoin exists. Bitcoin literally exists for this reason. If the corrupt politicians and regulators that maintain this system were willing to give us permission to fix it, we wouldn't need Bitcoin. But they will never give us that fucking permission, and our only option is to opt out and hold our own Bitcoin and just leave the fucking system.
Yeah.
What up, Tom?
What up, Matt? How you doing?
We have to turn on.
Oh, your mic's not on yet.
Not yet?
There we go.
How am I now?
You're good.
Hello, Matt.
We're just talking.
It's nice to see you.
We're just talking about this shit show.
It's a shit show. It's not great.
No.
It's really confusing. I don't know where I'm jumping in here. Have you guys covered like the Barney Frank and
that's,
signature
that's
stuff?
Actually, we were going to get to that next, and that's why I wanted to bring you in now, because I think you'll have a unique perspective on this, because it was different. So it was. We talked about Silicon Valley Bank. Like we were talking about
wait,
that.
Wait, let's start. Go back further. Silvergate gets run on first. The run starts in November. They have like over 90% of their deposits. Like over $8 billion is getting pulled out of their bank. They were relatively good risk management. So they lasted a pretty long time. Finally, the nail came in the coffin. Silvergate was a lot quicker. Silvergate kind of tried to do some kind of risk management, but they failed on the execution. They spooked the market. People saw that they were selling their bonds, their long-dated bonds. People saw that they were trying to sell some stock. The stock went down. Peter Thiel tells everyone to withdraw because of social media. It spreads like
Silicon
wildfire.
Valley Bank. Silicon Valley Bank. You said
yeah, this is Silicon Valley Bank. This is Silicon Valley Bank. And then on Sunday, without any warning, the Fed comes out and just shoots Silvergate behind the farmhouse and zeroes out all shareholders and says your deposits will be fully backed up. Okay, now we go.
No, Silvergate, or you're getting the names mixed up. Were you talking about Signature? Signature, yeah.
Sorry, like, my they're brain confusing.
So comparing...
So Silvergate, Silicon Valley, and then Signature.
One of the really confusing parts of the timeline here is there was a migration. There was sort of a flight to safety for Signature for a little bit there. I think Circle was one of them that sort of was indicating to the market that Signature was in a different position than Silvergate when the stuff started to hit with Silvergate. So there was at least a perception that Signature might be able to make it out of the mess. They weren't, you know, lending as aggressively as Silvergate was. But, you know, the shovel to the back of the head of Signature came as a surprise, I think.
Yeah, and there's two aspects to this that were really perplexing. Number one, comparing it to Silicon Valley Bank, when the feds finally said, all right, you're done, we're taking over. It was the FDIC who stepped in and took over and did all the receivership stuff. And then the two things that are weird about Signature is it wasn't the FDIC that stepped in. It was the New York Department of Financial Services, and they did it on a Sunday. They didn't even give them the opportunity to try to service withdrawals Monday morning, which I thought was very odd.
So, again, this is happening pretty fast. I haven't had too much time to catch up, but there is a back and forth between David Bailey and Nick Carter, which is pretty interesting. You know, Bailey has gone into the financials that were released by Signature and said that there is, you know, insolvency sort of here. Nick Carter is very much on the thread that, you know, this is sort of a hit job for, you know, crypto banks, sort of drawing on the, I guess, part of the story that Barney Frank injected into the collapse. It's, you know, pretty difficult to pull this apart. I don't think that we're going to, like, know what happened for, you know, a matter of, like, months here.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's another interesting aspect of this is Barney Frank sits on the board of Signature. Obviously, he was one of the senators who co-wrote the Dodd-Frank Act, which enacted all these new reserve and capital requirements in the wake of 2008. So you'd think, like, if that dude's on the board, like, maybe he has a higher incentive to make sure that everything's well capitalized. And then another interesting aspect using Silvergate and Signature as bookends is they both had similar products. Silvergate had SEN, their SEN network, and then Signature had Signet. And these networks allowed different companies in the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency ecosystem to send money instantly 24/7, 365. So they could, exchanges and other companies could send wires, or not really wires, use these networks to send money to each other when the banks were closed and wires weren't being processed over the weekend. And so I recorded an episode of Whitney Webb's podcast with her and Michael Krieger earlier this morning. And that, I think Michael Krieger is under the impression that this was an attack to shut down those two networks, particularly to really curb the growth of the crypto industry.
Could have been part of the timing too. If Signet was, you know, seeing a lot of activity over the weekend, that might have been why NYDFS stepped in when they did.
Yeah. But there's another aspect here too, because we have so the Signet product from Signature Bank, and I once again want to apologize to the freaks for my lack of sleep, and the SEN network from Silvergate was to transfer U.S. dollars between Bitcoin and quote unquote crypto companies. Now, another way that Bitcoin and crypto companies send money to each other, dollars to each other, or traders do, is through Circle's USDC, which is backed by BlackRock and Goldman. And now Circle had money that was stuck at Silicon Valley Bank and money that was stuck at Signature Bank. Their peg was breaking. They were at about 90 cents on the dollar. It looked like it was about to go into free fall, and it wasn't going to only impact centralized companies, but also the fake decentralized DeFi products on Ethereum. And when they came in and backstopped both SVB and Signature, they essentially backstopped USDC, which essentially backstops DAI, which essentially backstops the whole DeFi ecosystem. So there was a bailout here for a centralized stablecoin at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So one distinction here, though, that it's just a settlement of accounts within the bank for both SEN and Signet, right? These are just like ledger, you know, balances. Everybody has an account there. And if you're a large OTC desk, you know, let's say BlockFi, rest in peace, is, you know, trying to settle with Genesis.
Rest in peace.
Soon to be resting in peace. And I think, you know, these are just sort of like internal, you know, settlements of account. And I actually think that both of them are built on a fork of like a very, very like pared back fork of Ethereum or something like that. Whereas, yeah, USDC is a little bit more, you know, floating out in the open as a, you know, ERC-20 token, whatever.
But they're on all the networks, right? They're on like Tron and shit too.
Yeah, and there's a couple more headlines that have come out in the wake of Signature getting shut down, particularly one of which is weird, is that there's some investment banks looking to do restructuring and sell Signature to another bank, and they came out, I think it was Piper Sandler is the investment bank doing this deal, and they came out and said, okay, we can sell Signature to another bank, but there will be strings attached, mainly that they can't do business with the crypto companies that Signature's banking.
So Reuters broke that earlier this morning. I think that's what Nick and David have been going back and forth on today. There were two anonymous sources initially that confirmed that, and they've since come out, and the spokesperson for, I think for Signature, or maybe FDIC, whatever, said that that's not true, that they're not going to go after them. But there's a lot of confusion, like, because it is in line with what Barney Frank said. You know, he sits on the board of directors. He has a, you know, fiduciary responsibility to shareholders. There's going to be a shareholder suit for all three of these banks to see, you know, exactly what happened and, you know, pick apart the timeline. It's a shit show. it's an absolute shit show. So, you know, I think Reuters probably broke that a bit too fast, but there's like a lot of, you know, there's only so many things that you can sort of shrug your shoulders at and say, that's weird. Like, that's weird.
Yeah. It certainly does, even if all the facts aren't on the table yet, it does feel like a bit of an attack on the industry, particularly because it's Silvergate, SVB, and Signature. When Silvergate started going down, I mean, just knowing what companies were doing in the space, a lot of them were opening accounts at Silicon Valley Bank and Signature.
Yeah.
But this has turned into a systemic crisis. Like I mentioned earlier, it's beginning to bleed into the European markets. Credit Suisse is under a lot of stress. Deutsche Bank's under a lot of stress. More regional banks here in the United States are under a lot of stress. First Republic, their stock was halted this morning. It was down 30% on the open. And there was another regional bank here in the U.S. begins with a W. I can't recall it off the top of my head. They were limit down as well. Their stock got halted. So people may try to blame crypto.
They halted, what, 30 banking stocks on Monday?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's another interesting data point to bring in, too. JP Morgan, I guess they leaked this information to the market that the Fed is going to provide a $2 trillion backstop to smaller banks. They're officially not going to offer this backstop to the bigger systemic banks like JP Morgan, BOA, Wells Fargo. They have like a $2 trillion facility for smaller banks.
They also already did a $19 trillion bailout on the bonds.
Yeah.
For everybody.
Yeah, QE5 is here.
For sure. It's, yeah. I mean, I don't know how linked the European crisis is to sort of the regional bank crisis. I mean, Silicon Valley Bank was big. That was almost like WaMu big. Washington Mutual back in 2008 when they collapsed. Go ahead, Matt.
It's linked because all the banks are insolvent by design, and sure, everyone is just coming to this conclusion now at the same time.
Look, we're trying to simplify the system, all right? The consolidation is good. It's going to make things a lot easier for, you know, pretty much everybody. This is actually good for depositors and customers of these banks because, you know, there's too much choice in the system as it is. we need to simplify things.
If you can't read,
nationalize the banks.
Yeah, if you can't read Thomas's hungover voice, he's being facetious there. It was a late night beefsteak.
I mean, I think there's a strong argument here that the bond bailout portion is essentially a nationalization of the banks, or at least it's the first step towards a nationalization of every bank.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is. Like I said, like the amount of money printing that's going to follow all this is going to be unfathomable. And so I guess trying to make this a productive conversation in the context of what we're doing here as a Bitcoin podcast, obviously a lot of companies in the space are freaking out right now. So that's another aspect. Every company that I've been speaking to is trying to open literally like 10 to 15 bank accounts and spread their cash reserves across these banks. So that actually introduces like another interesting aspect to this, because I was talking to one of the founders who's doing this, and he just posited to me, like, just think that through. Like, if you have every company, not just in the Bitcoin space, but just generally opening up as many bank accounts as possible and then spreading those deposits out, like, these banks are going to be able to lend like they have in the past. Because everything's going to be spread thin.
I mean, if it's an attack on the industry, they're just not going to let that happen, right? Like, there's going to be much clearer guidelines that, like, you know, crypto's to be treated as, you know, the cannabis industry or whatever. And there's supposed to be some shutting off of the valve and the access.
Yeah.
It gets like way more complicated after that. I think, you know, spreading the accounts out, like, it makes sense right now, but I think in practice, like, it's just going to be way too difficult. Like, there's, you know, minimum balances at all of these, and just managing all of these like little safe haven accounts just ends up being too complicated. You know, I can see, you know, people starting to use things like Fidelity or Coinbase or, you know, maybe NYDIG and those guys as sort of like shadow accounts where they're holding much higher cash reserves. And then they're going in and out of whatever bank allows them to go in and out of there. I could see that happening in the near term as well.
Yeah.
Well, hold your cash and hold your crypto, like, you know, at one of these, you know, custodians.
Bitcoin fixes this. Every company should have a sizable runway in Bitcoin so that if a bank goes down, they can still make payroll. They can still have their business expenses. Like what, like the narrative we've seen about corporate treasuries has historically been the sailor school of thought. This idea that the reason you hold Bitcoin on your balance sheet is because you don't want the melting ice cube. You don't want your reserves getting debased. But I think there's a very, very strong narrative here that lines up with what we've talked about with Nigerians trying to get money out of their banks and not being able to spend without permission for companies. I think if you're a prudent operator and founder of one of these companies, you should be thinking about having a significant portion of your treasury in Bitcoin so that no matter what, you can always make these expenses and you can always operate your business.
Completely agree. And hold that portion of your treasury in a multi-sig address, have some stipulations in place of like who can sign and all that. I mean, it's interesting because it feels like an attack, but it's a beautiful thing of Bitcoin. When it gets attacked, when the industry gets attacked, like it only makes it stronger because you're going to have more companies adopting this strategy, getting funds diversified into Bitcoin outside of their bank accounts and then in self-custody, multi-sig self-custody specifically, which is a positive, but it is scary. And that gets to the overarching question, like, is this an attack? And if it is, how do we respond? I'm positing that to you, Thomas.
Yeah, no, I know. Is it an attack? I don't know if I'm ready to call it an attack yet. I think, you know, the thread that Bailey put out was, you know, pretty compelling. I think that signature probably was under like a lot of stress. And we're seeing it ripple to other banks. Like the real question is which banks were back to back with other ones, the banks that bank the banks, how much exposure did they actually have to a lot of this stuff? I think it could be sort of a residual narrative where, you know, this is something that they can point to sort of bail out sort of the, you know, the banking industry. Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it wasn't so much, you know, that these were like, you know, bad banks or they were bad loans or there's too much stress in the system and we raised, you know, rates too quickly. The crypto stuff really was the straw that broke the camel's back and we need to rein that in. And it'll just be a very easy shift for, I would say, you know, mainstream media and most people to be like, yeah, that makes sense. Because they're certainly, most people are not going to dive into, you know, the depth of, you know, banking mechanisms that led to sort of liquidity crises and, you know, loss of confidence and things like that. Like, not everybody has, like, sort of this level of baseline. Yeah. Or is even interested in, you know, getting there. It's too scary.
Well, that's why it's important. Go listen to the episode with Parker and Jesse, because that is the crux of the problem. It was going to be any bank. It just so happened to be cryptocurrency banks that it hit first, but Fed policy is literally like destroying the balance sheets of these banks because it's depreciating the price of the bonds that they hold.
Well, I mean, I would go a little bit further than that. I mean, I would say, Powell, even, you know, when rates started going up, right? The reasoning was, I mean, besides combating their quote unquote transitory inflation, was there was a bunch of zombie fiat companies that were benefiting from cheap money. And by tightening the money supply, by making money expensive, by making it harder to lend money, maybe some of these vulnerable companies would get exposed and the market would clean up a little bit, right? And when you look at that, right, where is the majority of the speculation that's happening? A lot of that speculation was happening in crypto land, right? FTX blew up, BlockFi blew up. And a lot of that speculation was happening in Silicon Valley land with venture funds. And so when you look at where we start to see the cracks happen first, it only goes to reason that those cracks would be visible first in crypto land and Silicon Valley land.
And the risk
doesn't mean
assets.
They cause... It doesn't mean they caused the Ponzi banking system. That already existed. But the first signs of those cracks are visible in those industries. And that makes complete sense to me. I mean, we saw this all kind of unfolding in November because we live in this world, right? So we saw the most speculative companies in the world, which are the crypto companies, not the Bitcoin companies, not the solid Bitcoin foundation companies, but the crypto companies. We saw those cracks first. And then all of a sudden you start to see the traditional VC funds, you know, getting banged by all the by money being expensive again.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. The those activities, whether it be crypto or venture, which are far out on the risk curve, it does make intuitive sense that they would fall first. And then in the context of Silicon Valley Bank, particularly too, they had some FTX like policies where like, hey, if we extend you a loan, you have to hold your company reserves here. So just increasing like the systemic risk of that one institution.
Who killed Terra Luna? It all started with that.
Signature Bank didn't kill itself was a funny name this week.
the teeny tiny domino was Terra Luna just like collapsing and setting off this like cascade. Yeah. And we still don't have a lot of clarity on, you know, whether it was a fund or whatever, like who went out and actually like demolished that.
Yeah.
That was like an adversarial attack, I think.
Well, it was also.
Yeah, I mean, it was either DCG. It was either DCG or Alameda FTX, the combination of the two.
Well, if we go with the theory that FTX is a government backed entity, it would make a lot of sense, you know.
But yeah. it both starts with rates rising, making money expensive, making capital no longer cheap, and a bunch of people that were very greedy and very short sighted that assumed that money would be cheap forever. That built up all this speculation and did not have any risk management whatsoever. But ultimately, our banking system is built on this. It's like one of those towers that like little kids make, right? Where they just try and go as tall as possible and they don't actually make it strong. And what happens? It just keeps toppling over and over again. So like I've seen a lot of takes like, why do we have bailouts? Like, why does this system allow bailouts to even happen in the first place? That's the wrong perspective. The perspective really is this system is predicated on the need for bailouts,
right?
Without bailouts, the whole thing fucking crumbles to its core very, very quickly. And the benefit we have being in Bitcoin and even the quote unquote crypto land is this is the first time we've ever gotten a bailout. I mean, I'm not even going to say we, like USDC got a bailout here. I have no exposure to USDC. I have no exposure to DeFi. But usually when crypto banks go down, when FTX goes down, when DCG goes down, when BlockFi goes down, you just lose your fucking money. And people learn, and the companies that are practicing prudent risk management that are built on solid foundations, a company like Unchained gets rewarded. But in our corrupt banking system, the traditional financial system, the banks that were doing prudent risk management, because there are banks out there that were doing prudent risk management, they get penalized in this situation because the banks that weren't doing it aren't getting punished, and the banks that were practicing good risk management get no benefit out of it whatsoever. They have less assets under management, they have less everything.
Yeah, and this brings up a good point, is just like expanding the attack surface of moral hazard, like with yet another bailout of the magnitude that we're witnessing right now. Like any bank, like the FDIC came and said, we will 100% insure all deposits. Like we'll backstop everything. Now the banks can just be like, all right, like we'll do whatever we want.
I do love the distinction that this isn't a bailout because they're not going to bail out the shareholders. They're going to fire, they're going to liquidate the management teams. Like that's sort of like, you know, the veiled threat or like message to,
that's like the crumb you throw the peasants. Like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, but and so this one's not a bailout because, you know, we're going to wipe out the bonuses of the executive team and the shareholders are fucked.
But I mean,
also one other point that you made with it, like, you know, with Celsius and BlockFi, we're still going to see how that makes its way through the bankruptcy proceedings and FTX as well. Like that's still an open question.
BlockFi almost got double rugged. If Silicon Valley Bank didn't get bailed out, they had like $273 million.
I think Celsius was, at Signature as well. Like that's brutal. And also where's the FTX capital?
This idea that backstopping the depositors isn't a bailout is obviously bullshit. It's a bailout.
But for sure.
I would say it is structurally different than the 2008 bailout. But Because in that situation, the shareholder stayed. But that second part of their announcement, the treating the bonds and mortgage-backed securities at par, is 100% aligned with the 2008 bailout. And it was preemptive for every other bank, because none of those bank shareholders are getting zeroed. None of those banks' leadership is losing their executive compensation and getting removed. And they all got a preemptive straight-up bailout. So there's a focus here on arguing over the semantics of that previous part. But that previous part is fucking tiny in comparison to how they're treating the bonds on this buy the fucking pump program, the BTFP program.
Yeah.
That is just a straight up bailout. And intentionally, I think they win the narrative war if we're arguing over semantics over SVB depositors and signature depositors. Because it's that second part that's the real big one.
Yeah. QE5.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one or two or three, right? Like WaMu, Lehman, Bear, Merrill, like they got, you know, the shovel to the back of the head back in 08. But, you know, the shareholders and, you know, the executive team to some extent got bailed out as they just merged into other larger entities. I mean, we're going to have to wait and see it, like exactly how they're going to treat the three S banks, right? Like all three of them are either going to get absorbed into something else. Like, I don't believe that Silvergate is going to proceed through like a normal bankruptcy, you know, proceeding, right? It's probably just going to get absorbed into something else.
Yeah. I think it's important. Like, you're a lawyer that has dealt with this type of stuff.
Recovering.
Before. Yeah.
One day at a time.
Yeah. And it's, so I want to bring this back to the context. Like, I think we all agree it's a bailout. Completely agree with you, Matt. Like, they're trying to pull people's attention to the depositor, not bailout, but the backstopping depositors, and pull attention away from this new facility they just introduced. But going back to, we know Elizabeth Warren's on the warpath. We know a bunch of other politicians are on the warpath. Let's be honest with ourselves. We're going to be used as scapegoats for this. How do we get in front of it and try to win the narrative battle here?
I think it's a rope-a-dope. I think that we're going right back to the mining stuff, you know, pretty soon. Some rumblings over a really, you know, bad New York Times article that's going to hit soon.
Tomorrow, I think.
Tomorrow. That'll be fun. So I think that it'll tack back to mining. They'll, you know, really focus on the environmental effects, and, you know, deal with, you know, some of the systemic risk in the banking system, right? I don't think that they really want to talk about, you know, why this had to happen, why it was, you know, guaranteeing depositors across the space, because that really just shows some systemic weaknesses that they really don't want to go anywhere near right now. So I think that's sort of like, you know, peters out a little bit. And we're going to see like a really big push against mining.
Bring it. These people have, I mean, it's funny too, because Parker and I were actually just joking about this before we came in here. Like, once all this shit breaks down, like, you can't get access to your money, like, nobody gives a fuck about climate change.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about something actionable, right, rather than trying to fight politicians on propaganda in a corrupt system, the actionable thing is hold your wealth in Bitcoin, learn best practices, learn how to self-custody, learn how to use your own node, and just opt out of the fucking system. In 2008, we didn't have Bitcoin. We didn't have the ability. In 2008, I was angry as fuck at how unfair the whole system was, how I was getting debased and having to pay for all this shit. But now, today, over the weekend, I slept fucking easy. I had no exposure to any of that shit because I opted out. I actually had a tool to opt out, the ability to choose my own destiny, to choose my own family's destiny.
I don't want to really live through the mandibles, though, right? Like, I think
choice, Tom. That's the problem.
There's a choice. I mean, look, I think there's still time to look. Bitcoin saves, right? And you can either look at it as, you know, getting out of the system and going somewhere else, but you always have to live in a society. You just are sort of like picking what society, I suppose. I think that there's still, you know, time to, like, you know, work with people and actually get them to understand what Bitcoin offers as an alternative solution. You know, I think some of that involves some, you know, good work that, like, you know, BPI is doing, Bitcoin Policy Institute, and trying to get, you know, a couple more friends in Washington to slow this down. Maybe a little bit more time to stack some more sats would be nice, but
I think we should plug the April 5th event if possible.
We're not quite ready with that.
Okay.
We are doing our part at PubKey to do a little bit of the advocacy, you know, policy work and win some more friends in Washington. But you know, when the invite is finalized, we'll definitely appreciate a plug for that. Yeah.
You mentioned Mandibles. Did you see I got Lionel Shriver, the author, to set up a Bitcoin wallet, and the freaks donated over a Bitcoin?
It's amazing. It's amazing.
The positive take here is, look, obviously when she started writing Mandibles in 2014, I think she was well within reason to think that Bitcoin wasn't going to be successful, that adoption wasn't going to happen, that the network wouldn't be more robust than it ever was.
How many references? There's just the one reference.
Just a single reference.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. So I think in a world where Bitcoin exists, it won't be as extreme as what Mandibles had, because people have this parallel system that they can escape to, right? They have lifeboats that they could go to. If the Titanic sinks and it has zero lifeboats, obviously everyone dies. If the Titanic sinks and there's a little bit of lifeboats, then it's a better situation. And if everyone knows how to use the lifeboats and there's sufficient lifeboats, then it's the best situation. But I think no matter what, if you look at this Ponzi system, there is no way that we reset the system and go back to solid foundations based on hard money without some level of chaos. There will be some level of chaos, and it's up to individuals essentially to protect themselves. So that darkness, that period of darkness is as quick and painless as possible, because there will, I'm like, I am 99% sure that the path to hyper-Bitcoinization is just billions of people getting rugged over and over again until they realize that they have to opt out and practice personal responsibility, and then we're on a Bitcoin standard. So it's just rug, and then Bitcoin standard. Like that is the path here, that it just seems obvious. Like I don't see how there's any other path.
We're going to get more of those.
We're definitely going to get rugged. Use Bitcoin as a tool to make the ruggings as least painful as possible.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tough out there right now, but it's also exhilarating because this is why we do what we do. And again, like I think last week and everything that's happened this week has completely validated why we do what we do. And going back to like the fear that the system has, at the banking system, the government, the Federal Reserve, and you mentioned this last week, Matt, but really I've been trying to think through it this week, like the concept of a crisis of this magnitude in the financial system in the age of social media has to be scaring the fuck out of the government, because information can spread so quickly. Like comparing the 08 financial crisis today is almost not even possible, because we have communication tools today that did not exist back then.
Yeah.
Yep.
We haven't heard a peep out of the Asian banks yet.
Right. Well, that's what Arthur Hayes came out and that he tweeted this morning, like, wait till the Asia wakes up later tonight. And he's predicting some trouble over there.
I mean, for sure. I mean, you know, to see what happened with Credit Suisse and the French banks getting into trouble, Italy is like apoplectic that they're continuing to raise rates. Like, you know, the European Union is not, you know, not one cohesive unit. Like, you know, like they pretend it to be. Like the different countries have completely different economic, you know, realities. So as that pulls apart, you know, who's back to back? You know, who's banking the banks? It's not going to be fun. Like I'm not really looking forward to it. It's going to be a pretty painful process. Even if you are fully on a Bitcoin standard on some, like, you know, ranch in Nevada or wherever they end up in the Mandibles or whatever. I think it's going to be painful for a lot of people.
Spoiler.
Sorry. I just assumed everybody's already read it at this point. If you haven't read it, buy a copy, read it. It's fantastic. Drop or everything.
If you wait long enough, you'll just live through it.
Yeah, pretty much. You'll just be there.
I'm thinking about picking it up. I might pick it up this weekend.
Have you read it?
No.
Really?
That's the ongoing. I'm all holding out.
I can tell you. Why are you holding out?
Just because I'm just going to have you read the book to me in small parts through the years on this show.
I can tell you, thanks to the freaks and their generous donations to Lionel. First of all, if that's not going to show her the power of Bitcoin, nothing will. But I mean, there's a good chance we might have a second book that's, you know, what is the situation with the Bitcoin standard happening? It'll be a much more optimistic book.
Maybe
something to look forward to in these trying times.
Mandibles is quite dark. I don't know if she does optimistic, but we'll see.
It doesn't seem like it after the episode you two recorded. It's a pretty big doomer.
Yeah.
Maybe this because
she didn't understand Bitcoin. That's what, like, I would be a massive doomer without Bitcoin.
It is a light in a dark world.
Yeah. So I guess this is just going to turn into a banking episode. We got to talk about it. Like, we have a list, but. Actually, since
that's why I wasn't going to make a list.
Since you're, maybe we'll talk about one Bitcoin thing in the mining world that happened this week. Luxor releasing their custom mining firmware.
Woo! When what's miner? It's a big deal. I think getting another player in the space that's focused on developing out the firmware and sort of this like mining OS sphere. Brains does excellent work. But there's a lot to do, and I think competition is a good thing. And the Luxor team, I think, has put out a really amazing product. And full disclosure, I'm an investor and advisor to Luxor, and I'm biased on this issue. But I'm excited to see these developments getting pushed out.
I paused there because I had to confirm that it's Antminer only, correct?
No, it's.
Does it have what's mine?
Yeah, it's Antminer only. It's Antminer only.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Somebody.
They say it's somewhere on the top of the page. I have a question here. Stop here. Oh, you moved. But aren't these fees really high?
What's that?
They're like advertising 2.8% mining fees.
I mean, it's sort of the value of the product, I suppose. Yeah, I'm sure that they put a lot of thought into the pricing mechanics. I'm not the right person to ask. You'd probably want to get an Ethan, Nick, or Guzman on here to dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the concept is you can charge. I imagine if you're putting your hash rate at Luxor, you probably get some relief on the pool fees, and then...
No, it shows it right here, Marty. Look at the chart he has up. Like, if you use Luxor OS and you point it to them, you can, and you have over 50 petahash in hash, you can reduce your fees from 2.8% to 2.6%.
And you just confirmed what I just said. You get some relief on the fees at the pool level. But, I mean...
Why are other pools zero, though, is sort of a better question, right? When they're able to lock in... and point to other services. So like Binance and, Foundry are able to utilize sort of the OTC desk and custody solutions and stuff like that that allow them to have that race to zero. But in general, I would say that the commercials behind just a pure mining pool are not the most attractive, business prospects. It's a very difficult business.
Yeah. I mean, and you can charge a fee because the miners' revenue increases 6% from this firmware. Like, paying 2.8% is worth it at the end of the day, and Luxor is running a business, and they have to get revenue.
I'm just thankful for transaction fees.
Yes.
And ordinals. Did you guys get your bubbles from Yuga?
God, no.
Your Yuga bubbles?
I know you did, you sicko.
I didn't. I did think it was fascinating, though. I watched the end of the auction, and that last like hour or so was actually like a really entertaining game. Whether or not there was going to be another block to sort of just reorder that leaderboard was kind of cool to watch.
Yeah, you explained this auction style to me last week. It is pretty interesting how you did it.
Yeah, so it was a 24-hour auction. The leaderboard had 288 spots. They did, I think 300 of these fucking bubbles. But they reserved 12 of them for, celebrities or donations or whatever to pump the project in a very Yuga fashion. But that 288 leaderboard gets rearranged when sort of you deposit Bitcoin into the address that the that's associated with the ordinal wallet that you post effectively. So each block, as it got closer to the 24-hour deadline, so it's the last block before that 24 hours hits, right? So, you know, in the last hour or so, are you getting 6 blocks? Are you getting 1 block? Are you getting 20 blocks that are just like, you know, chaotically reordering that leaderboard? Was a pretty cool thing to watch.
Have you enjoyed the Ordinals? More power to you.
I'm not going to be buying. Will never clear again.
I'm not going to be buying bubbles, so.
All right. Man, tough crowd on the Ordinals. You guys, they're excellent, all right?
I would not describe them as excellent.
0 day, WikiLeaks dumps. You know, like, think about it beyond like stupid NFTs. Like, they're good.
So there's a difference here.
So that's the inscriptions.
That's right? The same shit. It's graffiti in the Roman Forum. It's Junsith's. I'm a big Junsith.
If you don't believe in ordinal theory, because of our UTXO model, you can't actually transfer the inscriptions between each other.
Yeah, they're very
subjective.
Like,
I think there's an argument to be made that, first of all, we're going to see, I love my sci-fi, right? So we're going to see more book burnings, right? We're going to see more censorship. We're going to see more Amazon, you know, editing Kindle editions out from underneath people and essentially rugging people on knowledge. I think there's a strong argument that some texts maybe are inscribed onto the Bitcoin blockchain, right? Because they think it's worth the fee to preserve this knowledge in a world where books get burned,
get
metaphorically burned digitally. But that doesn't mean that those are getting transferred and sold around or whatever, right? That's just an inscription on the chain. It's arbitrary data put in the chain.
Yeah, that makes more sense to me, where you just do it, I don't want to say altruistically, but in a way in which, like, I want people to have access to this, and you inscribe it, and then anybody can download the chain state and access that data with some external software. It allows them to decode it. And then, yeah, moving to like the NFT stuff, like, that's never made sense to me, because you can't, like, it only makes sense if you like put it on a sats card and then hand somebody a sats card.
Yeah. An open dime.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, it doesn't matter at the end of the day. It's the same use, right? Block space is valuable. People are going to use it if they're paying for it, and it's a legal transaction, a valid transaction as far as the protocol is concerned. It's a good thing. There's more usage. Transaction fees go up. If people are trading, you know, dick inscriptions on the blockchain, like, so be it. Like, they're free to do so. And I actually think that we're getting a fair amount of research and development and innovation around these things. We have more people talking about, you know, the precise mechanisms of, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain.
Like, PSBTs particularly.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an overwhelming net positive. And if you haven't heard the Junsith interview, when he goes into just sort of like graffiti in the Roman Forum and makes that analogy to the Bitcoin blockchain, you should check out Junsith on Peter McCormick. That was live at PubKey. And it was, I think his articulation or explanation of that mechanism is just fantastic.
Yeah, as somebody with ASICs plugged in, the increased revenue has been nice.
Yeah, for sure. Mind it. You know, otherwise, you know, if it didn't go this way, what it means is that the block space is not valuable, right? This is sort of proving that it does have, you know, intrinsic value to it.
That's because people are confident that the transaction will live there forever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that should be expensive, right? It's good for the base chain. It's good for layer two. It's going to push a lot of activity up into Lightning. You know, it accidentally does NFTs better than Ethereum, which is just an added bonus as sort of like a hysterical fuck up. But I think that they're really interesting. And, you know, not for the Yuga Lab stuff, right? It's for, you know, the actual mechanisms here. Like, being able to inscribe something and have it permanently, you know, available, and opening up that spectrum of what you're able to inscribe, to include, you know, pictures, you know, audio files.
What would you say to Luke Dasher?
What? I love Luke.
He's not a big fan of this.
I understand. You know, he wants small blocks, and, you know, look, Knots from the beginning operated on a banned list. So, you know, now he just has more addresses to put on his list.
and don't forget about his mining pool, Eligius, which was the first mining pool to ever censor transactions in Bitcoin.
And he was inscribing Bible verses in the early days as well. So.
Right, Book of Eli. Like, you don't need to have, who was it, Denzel?
Yes.
Protecting it. Yeah, you just put it on the blockchain. Yeah. Let that protect it.
Yeah.
I do love the DiGiorno's thing. I can't talk about Luke without bringing up the dumping the DiGiorno's in a bucket of acid and then like adding them. Your product tastes like shit now after I put it in a bucket of acid. What the hell?
Trying to feed my family frozen pizza here.
Oh, the best.
Can you make it compatible with with rubbing alcohol, please?
Yeah.
All right. What else do we got here? What else is on top of mind?
Top of mind. I don't know. I'm also excited not to harp. We can move on from the Ordinals thing. I see how detached Matt is getting at the mere mention of Ordinals.
But, no, I mean, wait, Tom, before we move on, I mean,
yeah.
What do you think about my thoughts on Mempool's clearing?
What do you mean?
We have a bet.
So, I mean, I think I maybe I called it a tiny bit prematurely, but I do think this time is different. Like, this is we're getting close. If we're not already there, we're getting close to the situation where there'll essentially always be a wait list. Mempools will always be full to get into Bitcoin block space, that there's enough demand for our current block size. And let's be honest, we're never going to raise block size again, to the point where there'll always be full mempools.
That's so we sort of need it to be that way, right? We need the transaction fees to start, you know, carrying a bit more water than they have been. And that needs to continue over the, you know, however many coming cycles and halvings. I hope that's the case. I think it would be great if Ordinals are providing that. But that's one of the reasons why I thought the Yuga Labs 12-fold thing was so fascinating, because that was, you know, basically a tutorial on how mempools work, how to change transaction fees, how to, you know,
RBF.
Yeah, like, you know, this is a really cool mechanism for people to, you know, learn the nitty gritty. This is gamification of, you know, basic Bitcoin block mechanics. I hope that that's true. There's not the mempool, it's like separate ones. So, you know, I would imagine that the Luxor mempool is seeing much more ordinal activity than, you know, other pools that haven't been as sort of like, you know, supportive or on the bleeding edge of this stuff as they have.
Yeah, but
well, to be clear, it's not just ordinals. Like, I think there's going to be increasing demand for Bitcoin block space across the board.
Agreed.
For regular Bitcoin transactions as well. I mean, the banking system's falling apart.
Yeah, well, that's the big question. Is ordinals just a fad, not because people lose interest in it, but is there a point in the future where the economic, broadcasting a purely economic transaction is so valuable that it sort of prices them out, where more people are making large settlement transactions,
yeah,
and are more willing to attach a higher fee to that transaction?
Well, I think it depends on the economic activity. So very large transactions, you're going to want sort of on the base chain, and you're going to be a lot more comfortable paying a robust transaction fee to get it, you know, processed. It's going to push a lot of other activity. If that's true, it's going to push a lot of other activity to, you know, the Lightning Network and other types of transactions. I think that that's a net positive, honestly, for both. Whether or not they're staying power for ordinals, or we get, I don't know, what was like the most ridiculous, like, you know, DeFi concept. I'm sure that we'll see a wave of companies raising for, tokenization of Satoshis. Get your, like, you know, one day your Tesla is going to communicate with a recharging station over the Bitcoin blockchain to let it know when it needs to be serviced or some bullshit like that.
Well, that's the one that's, I think, with ordinals and ordinal theory generally, that really still puts a bad taste in my mouth, is this attempt to make it seem like Satoshis or UTXOs are non-fungible.
They're just like tokens, bro.
What do you mean?
I'm kidding. Sorry. I'm completely kidding. But another thing that this opens up, I was going to, you know, mention before, you know, Bitcoin doesn't have a UTXO set, right? Bitcoin Core and Knots operate, I believe Knots has a UTXO set, but not all Bitcoin Core lowercase c software needs to have it to be a fully functional member of, you know, the protocol.
The Bitcoin works on just transactions purely, right?
Yeah, they're flagged transactions. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, once we start to see, I think, more diversity of, you know, core software, core again, lowercase c, rather than the Bitcoin core project, I think that we'll start to see a lot of, you know, interesting approaches and differentiation between the different implementations.
Yeah. Matt, are you working right now? You're completely detached from this conversation.
It's ordinals. We can go back to the mandibles if you want. Is there going to be a movie? And if there was, who do you want to play?
I haven't read the book.
Definitely yet, so. Willing.
Yeah, how are you going to deal with the scene when he has to give up the dog?
Willing is the closest thing to a young Bitcoiner in that book.
For sure, for sure. You have to read it. It's an easy read. Yeah.
I don't. Now I'm detached from this conversation. I have no context of what's being discussed. So. I'm kidding. Yeah.
Where should we go next? What do you have on your
list? I think we tie back to the banking sector.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm just happy Arthur's back.
I am too. But like, do you think this is just like eye of the storm, lull in the activity? Treasury, FDIC, Fed have stepped in. Like, is this just a temporary solution to a problem that will get larger?
Yeah. I think that the Biden presser was what, like 4 minutes, 4.5 minutes. He pieced out pretty hard, yeah. No questions. I think that this is triage. I think that, you know, right now there's, you know, an emergency situation that needs to be worked out, and they don't even have sort of the, you know, the neat package on how they want to articulate some of this.
Yeah. If we use 2008 as an analog, I mean, you had the failure of WaMu, what, in like March of that year, and the fireworks didn't really go off until September.
For sure.
October.
For sure. I mean, you know, maybe this is a residual from, maybe it all was Sam, right? Alameda did Terra Luna, and, you know, Sam just absolutely spiked, you know, this massive exchange with massive loans lent out, and it just sort of is a butterfly effect or whatever.
Possible. And I mean, this would confirm my theory that he is a government actor that was sent to undermine the industry.
I think that there was a new article on him that just hit in terms of like how much money he got out. He transferred $2.2 billion.
Caroline only got $6 million. She got the shit end of the stick in this deal. Like, how does that happen? How was he allowed to personally transfer $2.2 billion?
I mean, look, depending on what bank he was using, maybe they did deserve to go under if they were, like, allowing these transactions. Who was FTX primarily banking with? They were probably across all three at that point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But imagine just, like, seeing some of these transactions and just, like, you know.
All right.
Legal risk and compliance. Fired. The whole division.
Not even a phone call. Like, Sam, we noticed you're trying to wire $2.2 billion from the company account to your personal account. Can we get a rationalization for this?
It's a very Calacanis move. to like tell founders to take custody of their funds. Do whatever it takes to get out of these banks.
Yeah, that's another thing we didn't even touch on. I mean, that was going on.
I think it was ridiculous. Right, even Peter Thiel's participation. I think it was absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, well, like the participation and then like the screeching on the back end, like bail us out. It's like you literally just
all
told
caps him. Buy guns and ammunition. Yeah, Jason's account was fucking hilarious.
You can't do that on Twitter. You can be discreet. You can look out for the interest of your portfolio companies. Like, the message itself is not the problem, but the you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. It's just a ridiculous thing. Even if there was, you know, a fire there, there's a different way to go about it.
Well, who yelled first? Was it Thiel? I mean, because that was the...
Liz Warren,
maybe. But, yeah, I mean, the thing was Peter, or founders, so I don't even know if it was Peter specifically, sent an email to all their portcos, like, hey, Silicon Valley Bank's going down, get out.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, some of those people shared the email.
Yeah, it was some of the founders, that's right. Yeah.
Texted all their friends, and then people tweeted out and TikToked it and shit. And
yeah, and then boom, bankrupt.
And the rest is history.
24 yeah. hours later, gone.
That's how it goes. Spreads like wildfire.
But it was also because, I mean, SVB, like I was saying earlier, SVB they failed on executing their like risk adjustment that they were doing. I mean, the CEO came out and he was like, what, he had a statement that came out while this was all unfolding. And he was like, as long as everyone doesn't withdraw their money at the same time, we're good. Like, who the fuck says that?
Yeah. I mean, that's another,
that's the worst possible comment you can make in that situation.
Like, it was a piss poor managed balance sheet too, because their debt instruments that they were using for liquidity were mortgage-backed securities, which are comparatively illiquid to something like government bonds. You can't just sell them.
But they had a bunch of 10-year treasuries too.
Yeah, but they were using the MBSs to service the withdrawals. And if you've ever seen Margin Call, I actually went back and watched Margin Call on Friday night with my brother. It's just like, I need to get back in this mood. But Margin Call makes it very clear, like, you're going to suffer losses if you try to sell these mortgage-backed securities in big tranches.
Yeah, for sure. No lessons were learned. Nothing ever dies. There's no consequences. We'll revisit the exact same thing in 4 years. I don't know, 8 years. Maybe it's a collapsing cycle.
Well, maybe that's the question. Well, that it certainly is. You get 2008 response to that. Fed starts unwinding that response in 2015, 2016. Actually, it was like 2016, 2017 they really started. Then 3 years later, not even. It really started September 2019 with the repo spasm. Something breaks 3 years into an unwinding in 2020. Turn the money printer back on. Year and a half later, they begin unwinding. And then 18 months late after that, like, everything breaks. So like the compression of these boom bust cycles is happening. These things are happening much quicker and at a greater scale as we move through time. And I think we ended on this. Like, I think this is the end all be all. I think this is the last time they're able to bail everybody out, print all this money. I think this is the last cycle.
I think the only real ability comes from sort of the trade partnerships that we have, right? I think looking at Russia and China and just sort of the global backdrop here, it's scary stuff. This could accelerate pretty quickly if this becomes a focal point for, you know, the conflict that we're presently in and some of the, you know, escalations that we've been looking at sort of, you know, a spread for Ukraine to other countries in the area, Taiwan. If it loops in, like, if their reaction to, you know, a collapsing dollar or a collapsing banking system is perceived as something that is, you know, hitting them in an outsized effect, then I think we're just going to see an escalation of the conflict pretty quickly.
Well, I don't even think it's them feeling like they're going to be affected by it. I think they're seeing it as an opportunity, because in the last week alone, we've had China open up a trade partnership with Iran, and Saudi, I think Credit Suisse went to Saudi particularly, was like, hey, can you help us with the bailout? And they're like, fuck off. And then today, Saudi Arabia and Russia announced that they're going to go forward with the OPEC production cuts. So really, like, squeezing the market.
Well, also the Swiss Central Bank said that they would back them up. So,
and they did, yeah. So that's important in the context of Credit Suisse. The Swiss National Bank stepped in last night and offered $54 billion of relief. And during the market open, the Credit Suisse, yeah, credit default swap spreads exploded higher. It's almost like I think the probability of Credit Suisse going under, if you're using the CDS markets as a barometer, is like almost certain.
Yeah. I think that that's right. I don't know. It could be an opportunity, but there's a lot of financial institutions in both of these countries and, you know, in these parts of the world that are heavily reliant on this system. Unless we see a Bancor thing to bring it back to the mandibles, because we're living in it, right? If they actually like pull away and there's, you know, the European Union in the middle, and there's, you know, not a cohesive, you know, a singular point of view for the union, then you would start to see fractures in that, as, you know, Italy maybe has different opinions from Germany or whatever.
Well, the way I kind of look at it is the weaker economies fail first. We have our privilege as the reserve currency still. The weaker economies fail first, then the U.S. dollar, you know, continues to falter, you know, inflation gets worse and worse, continues to run hot. I mean, they're going to print here. Inflation is just going to get worse from here. And then at that point, we're going to start to see attempts being made to do some kind of commodity-backed currency, but all of those require trust. And as that trust breaks down, we're left with a single option left over, which is Bitcoin to settle all these trades.
Yeah, I mean, like, and the concept of like a commodity-backed currency is already being eroded. I mean, you had the instance with the Western Australian gold mint getting called out by the Shanghai Gold Reserve for giving them like gold that was diluted. There was another,
just a little bit though.
There was another gold confiscation where the buyer was like, "Oh, this is tungsten." Like the confidence and the ability for,
it's like a gold IOU.
Yeah, for these commodity-backed currencies to even get off the ground is materially impaired by just the fuckery that's going around.
Look, I hope we're not in a complete, like, you know, fuck off mentality in terms of Bitcoin never really having any like, you know, any space for itself in the U.S. economy. Like there's clear solutions. If there's going to be an energy crisis, Bitcoin miners are very good at utilizing resources that we have domestically, and it can help build out much more robust like grid infrastructure. So, you know, the hope there is that this is a mechanism to onshore a lot of the stuff that has been offshored over, you know, the last like 40 years or whatever, and bringing a lot of industry back to the U.S. But, you know, I think it's better with Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin solves a lot of these problems and alleviates a lot of the pain points in that transition.
I agree. And this is why we have to keep doing what we do here, Matt. And you have to keep doing what you're doing at PubKey with your advocacy, Bitcoin Park, BPI. We really need to get out in front and say, hey, we know this is fucked up. You guys fucked up massively. Don't stop us from helping solve the problem.
Help us help you.
Yes, exactly. Help us help you.
I mean, specifically, if you're an American Bitcoin company, you're very exposed to short-term, shitty, corrupt legislation, and you should consider supporting Bitcoin Policy Institute. Like, they are doing fantastic work. If you're an individual Bitcoiner, I don't think that value prop is necessarily that clear. But if you're running a business that is based in America and relies on American regulation to not be absolutely horrible, there is no better group of people to support on that effort than Bitcoin Policy Institute.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. I have to run to a 1:30 here. Thomas, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Guys, never always forget, fun. We're going to win.
It's fine. This was a dark one.
We're going to win. We're going to let them help. We're going to let them help us help. We're going to let them. Let us. We're going to help them. Let us help them.
Yes.
There we go.
You got it.
Freaks. Get your house in order. Get your shit in order. Get your Bitcoin strategy in order. Things can get very dark very quickly. Like, you just need to be prepared for the worst case scenario and hope for the best. Consider listening to the most recent Citadel Dispatch episode with Jesse Myers. It is fucking fire. I appreciate you all. You guys have a great time in Austin tonight and tomorrow. I'm sorry I will not be making it there. And stay humble, stack sets.
Peace and love, freaks. Get the pub key.